Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
A troubled marriage leads to divorce and a bitter custody battle with two young children caught in the middle. In 2011, Julia Birakova and her two children, 4-year-old Miley and 2-year-old Sky, were living in an apartment in Redmond, Washington. On November 6, 2011, Julia and her children were up early. Sky was sick and she needed to take him to the hospital. She bundled the children into her brother's car that she was borrowing and headed to the Overlake Medical Center. But they never arrived. According to Julia, the car ran out of gas on the way. She left Sky strapped in his car seat as she and Miley went to go get help. But when she returned, her son was gone. Sky's father, Solomon Metalwala, was immediately suspicious of his estranged wife's story, as were Bellevue police. However, it's been over a decade since Sky was last seen, and there have been no arrests in his case or answers as to what happened to the little boy on that November morning. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Sky Metalwala. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the story going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, this case is another listener request.
Okay.
And like any case that involves a small child, it's a tough one. Sky had just turned 2 years old a few months before his disappearance. And this is also a case that seems as though it should have been solved. Though admittedly, there is a lack of direct evidence, but obviously we're going to talk about all of that in the episode.
Just from the intro, I've got like a million questions.
Yeah. Hold your questions for later, please.
Okay.
Before we get started, though, we have had some folks join us over on Patreon, so I want to make sure I give them a shout out. So thank you very much to Mary P., Hannah K., Courtney, Sierra D., Tilda, Jessica W., Tatlana K., Kimberly, Miranda L., and Rosemarl C. We really appreciate you so much.
Thank you all so very, very much.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a higher number than normal. We tend to get a high number of subscribers when we do two-part episodes because you can get the second part early. And just if you haven't looked at the runtime on this episode, like, this is a long one. And ordinarily, I would have made it two parts, but I cannot do that to you guys again because our last two like regular episodes were both two-parters. So I'm not going to do it three times in a row. And, you know, we were off last week because I had COVID. So this week you're just going to get an extra long, in-depth, crazy episode.
Let's just power through it.
Yeah. So like, sorry to those who don't like that, but you're welcome to those who do. I don't know. I can't please anybody. I'm trying. And as a reminder, you can get access to ad-free episodes by joining our Patreon on any level or by subscribing on Apple Podcasts. So now that we've gotten all that out of the way, let's get right into the case of Sky Metalwala. Sky Elijah Metalwala was born on September 6, 2009 to Julia Birakova and Solomon Metalwala. His older sister Miley was about two when he was born. Solomon and Julia had been together for about a decade by this point and had been married since 2003. Their love story wasn't exactly romantic, however. Solomon and his family had immigrated to America from Pakistan, and in 1997, he was 21 years old and running a convenience store. Julia's family is Ukrainian, and she was born in Soviet Russia. They came to America when Julia was 12. In 1997, she was 15, so she'd only been in the country for 3 years, and she met Solomon at the gas station that he was running. Solomon invited the high school student to a party, and the two began dating.
Yikes.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot there culturally, as well as, like, you know, obviously age. The legal aspects of that. But
it's not great. And according to Nadia, Julia's mother, like, she and Julia barely even spoke English at this point.
Yeah, plus a Russian and a Pakistani
getting
together, like, that's not good.
So Julia finished high school, and in 1999, she got a job at a restaurant owned by Solomon's family. Now, this was interesting, actually, and I don't want to get, like, too in-depth into this, because Lord knows I get in-depth into a bunch of stuff in this episode, but this restaurant was called, like, the King Street Cafe. Cafe was with a K. Basically, Julia and her family were under the impression that, like, this was their restaurant, their deli that they were running. And she was like, I'm a business owner. This is amazing. I'm 18 years old. Like, I have my own business. I got this guy. Like, we're doing great. And several years later, she, like, realized that they didn't actually own it at all, that Solomon's family owned it, and they were just basically working there.
Mm.
I mean, I think they were getting the profits, but, like, it wasn't in their names, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's kind of an aside, but it's just one of those things that kind of gives a picture of what this relationship was like.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're running this business, and then they moved in together and bought a condo in Bellevue, Washington. So they lived and worked together and enjoyed the same activities, including yoga and kickboxing. You know, and their relationship is interesting because it seems as though they both cared deeply for each other. But it was a volatile relationship. Like, they fought a lot. And one time the police were even called when they argued at a gas station. They were apparently, like, arguing about what they were going to do that night, and it just got out of hand, I guess. Julia later told a psychologist, I mean, years later, that Solomon was controlling and that she had become dependent on him, which, given that she was 15 when they got together,
yeah,
completely makes sense.
Yeah, that all matches.
Exactly, it tracks. Yeah. Julia also claimed that as a child, like in Russia, she had been subjected to daily beatings and confinement to mental hospitals, where her treatments included electroshock therapy.
Jesus.
Yeah. And I don't have a ton of details on those allegations, but like I said, she just kind of claimed to have a very rough childhood, and mental health issues apparently, you know, were always a part of her life to some extent or another, but it's really hard to determine what's real and what other people maybe told her was wrong with her.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, it is. So in 2003, and this is according to later court documents, Julia alleged that Solomon's family told her that Solomon was going to be deported.
Okay.
Now, I don't have any reason why he was going to be deported at all, but the family gave her two choices, either marry him or never see him again.
Okay.
And they're like, I'm not an immigration lawyer, but I'm fairly certain that's not how that works.
Yeah.
You know, like a green card marriage, quote unquote, like, it's a lot more involved than TV and movies make it seem.
Yeah.
So we don't need to get into all of that. The point is that in 2003, Julia was told that if she didn't marry Solomon, he was going to be deported. So she agreed to marry him, and they had a small ceremony in his mother's kitchen.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a lot already. And that's why this ended up being so long, because there's a lot of background within this family before we even get to the actual disappearance. So this quickie wedding didn't exactly lead to marital bliss. Shocker.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2005, the couple began to face financial problems. Now, a deli moved in next door to their restaurant, and it cut into their business severely. Then the nationwide economic downturn that followed harmed them even more. So, you know, starting in 2006, 7, 8, like it was a rough time economically in this country for everybody, and they got hit hard with it. Now, as they were going through these struggles, Solomon converted from Islam to Christianity.
Oh, probably not to the liking of his family.
Yeah, yes, very true. So he became extremely religious. And according to court documents, this did cause a rift between Solomon and his family. It also seemingly caused problems in his marriage.
Hmm.
Julia described Solomon as, quote, very controlling, declared himself to be a Christ-like figure who had great persuasive skills due to his charisma, end quote.
Oh, so that has nothing to do with the converting religions. It just has to do with the fact that he is a fucking megalomaniac.
Yeah, that's what it would sound like, right? So the documents go on to say, quote, an emotional abuse pattern insidiously set in whereby Julia gradually became dependent upon Solomon for her very identity and self-esteem, end right. quote.
Yeah, which is pretty typical of like that type of relationship and behavior.
Yeah. Julia and Solomon's first child, Miley, was born in 2007. And the next year, despite their struggling business, they bought a home in nearby Kirkland for over $800,000.
Jesus.
Yeah. And so I always pegged 2008 as when the market crashed.
Right.
And you couldn't get mortgages anymore. But I guess they snuck in like right under the wire. And they got one of those insane mortgages that caused
the whole
real estate crash.
Yes, right.
Because they did not have the means to pay this.
Right.
Now, they did not sell their condo. They wanted to hold on to it and keep it as a rental property. But before they were able to find a renter, you know, they just had two mortgages.
Cool.
Yeah. According to Julia, she wasn't deeply involved in the family's finances. Which is mistake number one, always, always know how much money is around. In 2009, she was pregnant and Skye was born on September 5th. And it was during this time that Julia says she realized the extent of the family's financial troubles. In court documents, she said, quote, I learned about the extent of our debt from my husband when we were 6 months behind on paying our two mortgages, utilities, credit cards, and all other bills. This is the time when my husband's anger and his true character began to show, end quote. And I mean, that sounds stressful.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think even like the gentlest person would probably show some anger and stress and bad characteristics during that point, right? Mm. Now, Julia, as I mentioned, had struggled with mental health issues, which were likely exacerbated by her pregnancy and then by having an infant and a toddler, all while dealing with these severe financial difficulties. In fact, in the fall of 2009, right around the time Skye was born, the Kirkland house was foreclosed upon and the family was forced back to move into their condo in Bellevue.
Well, I mean, at least they had a place to go.
Well, exactly. But, you know, it's interesting because as I was like reading court documents, they actually flip-flopped between the two houses during her entire pregnancy with Skye because they were living in that big house and the house became too overwhelming for her. So she was like, let's move to the condo because it'll be more manageable. So they moved to the condo and then she's like, oh, I don't want to move here. I want to move back to the big house. They moved back to the big house and then that was foreclosed upon. Then they had to move to the condo. So it was a lot of back and forth. And according to Solomon, you know, they were trying to make the condo into a rental property, but with the constant back and forth, they weren't really able to get a tenant, which further contributed to their financial problems.
Yeah.
So it just seems like a giant mess all around. And a very stressful thing to deal with while you're having a baby and you have a toddler already. According to Solomon, living with Julia became difficult during this time. She had previously been diagnosed as bipolar, along with having obsessive compulsive disorder. He told the court that her obsession with keeping their condo clean led him to eat outside of the home with his children and often sleep either on the floor or in his car. Solomon said that her actions also caused his children to suffer, saying, quote, "I am not exaggerating when I state under oath that Julia cared more about cleaning a countertop than she did about feeding her daughter. The child was ignored and it became a matter of great concern," end quote. Solomon goes into more depth in his court filings where he talks about how he would be at the store working. So basically, as soon as the children were born, Julia stopped working at the store. She became a stay-at-home mom. Solomon said he would be at the store and Julia would make Miley sleep all day, like till 2 p.m. so that she could clean, and then like wouldn't feed her because she didn't want food to contaminate the house. And so like he would have to come home and then he would take her out to this deli and feed her, and they would stay out till like 10 p.m. And I mean, like I said, it goes into a lot of depth, but he said that it was just this untenable living situation and that she was not properly caring for the children.
Got it.
Simon's claims in court became even more worrisome. He said, quote, "By March 2010, Julia would not leave the house on time to go anywhere. She was like a prisoner who locked herself into a cell block. She began to have dreams about killing our children, even telling me of her dreams about strangling our youngest child. This became very scary, and I knew it was time I had to do something," end quote. Julia was committed to psychiatric hospitals three times for her illnesses, twice involuntarily. During this time Solomon was speaking about, Julia was home alone with Sky, who was 6 months old at the time. And this, incidentally, was Julia's 29th birthday, the day that this happened. So she sent a text to Solomon that said, quote, "Please, please, I'm begging with my whole heart, help me find a peaceful way to die. I cannot live another day and cause you, Miley, and Sky any more suffering. I'm dead inside anyway and have been dead for a long time. You will not miss me at all, and Miley and Sky have the best daddy in the world, so I know they will be okay," end quote.
And this comes from like actual text message evidence?
Yes.
So this is not something that he's just saying?
Correct. This has been, that text has been corroborated.
Wow. That's a lot.
It is. And so, yes, all of this other stuff that I've been telling you is just from his declaration, right? So like, this is all according to him, but that particular text message has been corroborated. And so he called the police that day. So he was, I assume, at work. I don't know where he was, but he wasn't at home. So he called the police and had them go to the house because, like I said, she was alone.
With the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when the police arrived, Julia admitted to having suicidal thoughts. However, she later denied this, claiming that she had made those statements, like the text messages, to get her husband's attention.
Okay.
However, Julia was committed to Overlake Hospital and then sent to Navos in Seattle. So it was, those are the two involuntary commitments. While she was being treated at Navos, Julia was given the Global Assessment of Functioning. This test is used to determine the psychological functioning of adults. Patients can score from 1 to 100, with a lower score meaning that they are potentially a harm to themselves or others. When she was admitted, Julia scored a 15, which meant that she was, in fact,
really low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A danger to herself or others. By the time she was released, she scored a 40. A 40 means that she isn't necessarily a danger, but does have some impairment for daily activities.
Right.
After the two involuntary confinements, Solomon and his brother Suleiman took her to the University of Washington Medical Center, where she checked herself in voluntarily.
Can we use air quotes around that?
We can, because Julia did later say that she did not check herself in voluntarily, that basically Solomon made her check herself in. So while it wasn't involuntary in the legal sense,
sure,
she felt very coerced.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't show up with your brother and like,
right,
pick up your wife from, you know, a mental health hospital.
Yeah. And in fact, she would later say, too, that like the second commitment when she got transferred to Navos, like, was basically because Solomon like told her she couldn't come home.
Yeah, I'm getting the impression that there's obviously there's a lot going on, but
yeah,
you know, she has a history of mental health issues, but also like he's super controlling, and so I feel like there's a lot of areas here where that would require deeper exploration.
Absolutely. I don't think you can take anything in this story at face value.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's really kind of what I'm getting as well.
Yeah. So while all of this is happening, and this is, of course, like over the course of a couple months, you know, that we're talking, I don't know the exact timing, but her birthday's like the beginning of March, and that's when all of this first went down. I think she spent all of March, all of April, and maybe even part of May in these hospitals. So like we're talking quite a long period of time. Things started falling apart at home while she's gone. The bank foreclosed on the condo, and Solomon moved into his mother's house with their children. Solomon and Julia's marriage, you know, by this point was effectively over. And when she was released from the third hospital, she no longer had a place to live. Like, the condo is gone. Solomon moved in with his parents, and he's like, we're done. So according to a letter that her brother, Stan Baryukova, submitted to the court, Solomon refused to give Julia any money or help her. One of her friends, a woman named Shelby, agreed to take Julia in. Now, Sky, who was under a year old at this time, it sounds like stayed with Julia while Miley stayed with Solomon. According to Stan, Julia was lost during this time and was completely unable to support herself. But because she and Solomon were still married, he wasn't under any like court obligation to give her money or anything like that. There was no support, you know.
Yeah.
So she was just kind of SOL. And apparently, like, he would give her money here or there, or like reimburse Shelby for things that she was paying for. But it was kind of few and far between from what it seemed like. By June 2010, Shelby told Julia that, you know, it was just too much for her. Like, Shelby had three kids of her own. She was driving like Julia to all of her appointments because Julia didn't have a car. And, you know, it was just a whole thing. So she's like, listen, I'm sorry, but you've got to find someplace else to live. With nowhere else to go, Julia moved in with her mother, Nadia. On June 10th, 2010, Solomon served Julia with divorce papers and a proposal for temporary custody of Sky. And this started an ugly court battle that went on for over a year.
Did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right, it's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. Hey everyone, it's Kona, host of And Then They Were Gone, and I am coming to you today to talk about True Diagnostic. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent straight to your door. True Age is actually sending me a test, and I'm really excited to see what it's going to say about my health. And frankly, a little frightened. Because even though I'm afraid it's going to tell me that my biological age is higher than my normal age, it's definitely information that I can use. Because by tracking my biological age, I can actually see how changes that I make, whether exercise, diet, or sleep, can affect my health over time. And this isn't guesswork. The True Age test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working with Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I don't know. I like to know everything, so I think it's going to be really cool to know exactly how my lifestyle is impacting my body. I already know there's definitely room for improvement, and I think this is going to give me some actionable steps. So if you're ready to join me and find out your biological age, right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code ATTWG at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code ATTWG to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. In court, Julia defended herself and made some accusations of her own. In a July 2nd, 2010 statement, a clinical psychologist who had treated Julia wrote a statement saying, quote, "Although Ms. Buryukova is dealing with a severe form of OCD, I do not believe this interferes with her ability to be a compassionate, effective parent to her children," end quote. However, Julie disputes this diagnosis and in court records filed on September 23, 2010 says, quote, "I do not suffer from severe OCD and I never have," end quote.
So, okay, wait. So she has this doctor testify on her behalf.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Saying that, yeah, she's got OCD, but she's mentally fit to be a parent. And then she comes back and is like, "I don't have OCD."
Well, okay, that was my impression too when I read this. But then I read more of the court documents and I understand why she said that. Okay. So let's, yeah, talk about that a little bit more. Now, she also said, again, that the statement that she had made over text, that, you know, "please help me die" statement, was just to get her husband's attention. And she was basically making the case that Solomon had overblown her struggles with mental illness. Julia's mother, Nadia Buryukova, initially told the court, quote, "Neither your husband nor I would like for you to live with us at your current conditions. All of us, your children including, are suffering from your abuse," end quote. So obviously, bad thing for your own mother to say to you, to say about you in a court document. However, later, Nadia said of Solomon, quote, "little by little, he convinced me that my daughter was sick," end quote. In fact, a separate psychologist found that Julia was, quote, "an intense young woman whose only interest is to provide a good life for her two children," end quote. And in this declaration that Julia filed on September 23rd, 2010, she painted a picture of a man who used her mental health struggles against her and blew them out of proportion in an effort to maintain control of her and their children. And she had yet another doctor back this up. Dr. Scholl, a founding fellow of the Academy of Cognitive Therapy, said, quote, "Ms. Buryukova's obsessive-like behavior was, I believe, a response to the severe stress she was placed under by trying to cope with marital and financial difficulties, which she couldn't understand and made no sense to her," end quote. Julia also claimed that Solomon attended all of her psychiatric appointments and basically became her spokesperson.
Yeah, that's extremely controlling.
Yeah. So, you know, they go in and he'd basically say what was wrong with her and the problem she was having and et cetera. And she would just let him speak for her because having been with him since she was 15, she said that at the time she believed that Solomon knew her better than she knew herself. And it is really interesting because she gets more into depth about it. She's like, "listen, I've always been a neat and orderly person, but like these things that he's describing, like simply did not happen." She says, "yes, I clean, but, you know, I also feed my children and, you know, I also do this, that, and other." So it really becomes like a he said, she said type thing. And it's just a mess, really. But she also told the court that in addition to being controlling, Solomon was abusive to both her and the children. According to an in-depth article in the Kirkland Reporter, witnesses corroborated her claims that she had been the victim of domestic violence on three separate occasions. Julia said she was afraid of her husband, saying, quote, "now my fears for my small children. And now Solomon is doing the same thing to our small children that he did to me, physically abuse them and try to control them," end quote. Sue Jewett was a lay pastor at City Church, the church that the family attended. She had been counseling the couple and said that after a visit with Solomon in November 2010, Julia noticed red marks on Skye's lower back, hip, and upper buttocks. She further stated that Miley had told both her and Julia that Solomon had gotten mad at Skye because Skye was crying, so he hit him. This claim was recorded by Sue along with other statements from Miley. So they had audio recordings of her saying this.
A psychiatrist testified, quote, "This little girl became so desperate for help during these painful transitions that she began praying to Jesus for relief, to no avail, when her father picked her up." Miley averred that she gets spanked on her buttocks, legs, and stomach while her father tells her that he does not love her, end quote.
Jesus Christ. That is a lot.
It's a lot. Solomon denied the abuse allegations and said that the beatings with a wooden spoon were from Julia's childhood. Like, that was not something that happened in their house. That was something that happened to Julia when she was a child, and that she was the one who was abusive toward the children. So obviously, Child Protective Services got involved.
As they should have.
Yes. And they made 6 visits to the family from late 2009 to late 2010. So basically in a 1-year period. In August 2010, they determined that the abuse allegations against Julia were unfounded.
Okay.
On December 19th, 2010, Julia made another devastating claim that Solomon had sexually abused their daughter.
Okay. So CPS came in after a while. They said that that Julia was clear. But they weren't investigating Solomon?
They were, but I guess that investigation was still ongoing. And then Julia, well, so while they were investigating the physical abuse allegations, Julia then made sexual abuse allegations.
Okay.
So the entire investigation was ongoing for quite a while. During the course of this CPS investigation, Solomon was given a polygraph. When he was asked if he had hit Miley with a wooden spoon, he denied it, and the polygrapher deemed the statement to be truthful. However, when he was asked if he had caused the bruising on his daughter's back, the test came back inconclusive.
Well, I don't put
right
any stock in,
yeah,
you know,
polygraphs. But I'm just saying, so like it was just a long investigation is the point. And
where were the kids during this investigation?
They were with Julia.
Okay.
Because she had been cleared.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So they stayed with her.
Okay.
Miley was forensically interviewed by a psychiatrist about the abuse, and CPS stated that she, quote, was able to provide a consistent and credible statement that the father inflicted the bruises on her back with a wooden spoon, end quote. In September 2010, Julia was granted full custody of both Miley and Sky. Solomon was not granted visitation rights, presumably because the investigation was still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
This arrangement lasted for the next year, though the fight was not over. The CPS investigation eventually concluded that the allegations against Solomon were unfounded.
I mean, it's hard to prove.
He was still fighting for visitation with his children, but Julia seemingly had no interest in letting him see them. On October 25th, 2011, she offered to forego $2,000 he owed her in child support if he would let her move with the children to Arizona, but Solomon refused.
Yeah, obviously he's got control issues, so he's not going to just let them.
Right, but they're also in Washington State, so I mean, that is... very far away.
I get that, but I feel like that's more of the control issue than just like, I don't want you out of state.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, also by this point, he hadn't seen his kids in a year.
Yeah.
So anyway, in November 1st, 2011, the couple underwent a court-ordered mediation session in hopes of bringing this very protracted custody battle to a conclusion. The heated session lasted 11 hours, but brought about some big changes. At the end of the mediation session, both parties compromised and signed an agreement that allowed Julia to retain full custody of the children, but did grant visitation to Solomon. By this point, like I said, it had been over a year since he had seen either of his children, and he was scheduled to have his first visit with them the next week on November 9th. However, the day after the mediation session, Julia tried to back out of the agreement, telling her lawyer that she had felt pressured into signing. It looked as though the ongoing custody battle wasn't over after all. Julia and Solomon were likely heading back to court to duke it out once again. At least they would have been, except for what happened on November 6th. According to Julia, on the morning of Sunday, November 6, 2011, Sky woke up sick. We don't know what his symptoms were, but they were allegedly serious enough that Julia believed that she needed to take him to the hospital. At 7:20 a.m., she bundled Miley and Sky into a car that she was borrowing from her brother and set off for the Overlake Hospital Medical Center in Bellevue, about 15 minutes away. But they never arrived. According to Julia, her car stopped running, either due to a mechanical issue or because it ran out of gas. She left the car at the corner of Northeast 24th Street and 112th Avenue Northeast in Bellevue. It was around 38 degrees that morning, and Julia said that because Sky was sick, she didn't want to expose him to the cold. So instead, she left him strapped in his car seat and took Miley in search of a gas station.
Can I ask questions yet?
Yeah, you can ask questions, but I might tell you we're going to get to it.
Okay. Was he exhibiting any symptoms that we know of beforehand, before this morning?
Don't know.
Okay.
The only thing we know is that apparently that morning she emailed a friend. We don't know which friend. We don't know what time. But apparently she did send an email saying that Sky was sick. But to our knowledge, nothing was said before that morning.
Okay. What was the neighborhood like where her car was?
I'm going to talk about that.
Okay.
So Julia and Miley walked up 24th Street for nearly a mile before they reached a gas station. But here's the thing. To your question, they were not in the middle of nowhere. Directly across the street from where she left her car was a Montessori school. Now, of course, being a Sunday morning, the school was not open, so that was no help. But if you continue to go down her route using Google Maps, you can see that 24th Street goes through what looks like a really nice neighborhood. So why not go to a nearby house and ask for help instead of leaving your toddler in the car and walking to a gas station nearly a mile away with your four-year-old?
Right.
Now, one could say because she just really wanted to get gas and get out of there. Like, that was the plan. You know, she didn't want to stop at a phone and, like, call anybody, or she didn't have anybody to call, you could say. She was just, like, trying to get gas and, you know, they're not going to have gas at a residential house. So that's one explanation, except for the fact that Julia didn't have her wallet with her. She had apparently left the house that morning without her wallet, ID, or cell phone.
And this is according to who?
Her and, you know, police. Like,
oh, so she admitted
yeah.
that she didn't have her wallet.
Uh-huh. She didn't have anything. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, people forget things, especially if they're worried about their sick child and trying to get two little kids into a car at 7 a.m.
Absolutely.
And one's sick. You know, like, I can totally forget just flaking and, like, leaving stuff behind, especially if you've got a purse and your wallet, ID, and cell phone are all in the purse. It's not like you're leaving three separate things behind. You just leave your purse behind, right?
Right.
But by the time she's heading off in search of a gas station, she had to have known that she didn't have any of those things.
Right.
So she wasn't going to be able to go buy gas and get back to her car quickly. Now, the other strange thing about her route is that she took 24th Street because she was at a corner of 24th and 112th. She walked 0.7 miles to the Chevron station on 24th Street. But if she would have gone down 112th Street instead, which was the road she had been traveling on, she would have made it to the hospital in 1.3 miles.
But did she know that?
Well, that was where she was heading.
Sure, but you said she didn't have her cell phone on her, so she wasn't using GPS, so she may not have known how close the hospital was versus how close a gas station was.
Right. But I mean, why would she go on a completely different street than the one she was already traveling on when, like you said, she didn't have a GPS? So how would she know it was down 24th Street?
That's fair.
You know, she knew that the hospital was on 112th Street. So why not just continue on that route and hope that maybe there's a gas station or something on the way, if not the hospital itself?
Bring your sick toddler along with you and just walk to the hospital.
Right. But she didn't do that. So instead of taking both of the kids and walking to the hospital or stopping at a nearby house, she walked away from the hospital to a gas station where she didn't try to get gas. Instead, she called her friend Shelby,
the same friend who let Julia stay with her after she was released from the hospital, and asked Shelby to come pick her up. I don't know where Shelby was when Julia called, but given that it was a Sunday morning and, you know, pretty early, like, I think there's a good chance that she was at home.
Mm-hmm.
Shelby lived in Renton, Washington, which was about 15 miles away from the Chevron station where Julia and Miley were. Now, depending on traffic, that drive is anywhere from 26 to 37 minutes. So Julia decided to wait there for at least half an hour for Shelby instead of going back to the car to check on her son.
Yeah, I mean, none of this is checking out.
So Shelby arrived sometime, I'm guessing, around 9:30 or so. 9:30, 9:40, somewhere in there. This is about 2 hours after Julia and her kids left their apartment that morning to make what was supposed to be a 15-minute drive. Shelby drove Julia and Miley back to their car, but when they arrived, Sky wasn't there. At 9:50 a.m., a frantic Julia called 911. So the 911 call was made in 2.5 hours after they left the apartment. Police responded immediately and searched the 20-block radius around Julia's car. They went door to door and asked if anyone had seen anything. You know, they even did roadblocks at one point and stopped people to ask questions. I mean, they did a very thorough, from what it sounds like, physical search of the area. One passerby did report seeing the car at around 8:50 that morning, but said that it appeared to be empty. And, you know, that's not definitive because you wouldn't necessarily see if a child is in a car seat. You would just, you know, potentially see the car seat.
Yep. And I mean, potentially.
Sure. Yeah. And according to the timeline, I mean, Julia and Miley wouldn't have been there. They were at the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could go either way. Right. So that is the only witness that I've read about that came forward. Julia gave police the story about the hospital and the car running out of gas, but police were immediately suspicious. That suspicion only grew when no sign of the little boy was found anywhere near the car. Solomon was informed that Sky was missing later that morning as he was getting ready for church. He went down to the police station and answered questions, but maintained that it had been over a year since he had seen either of his children. Meanwhile, Bellevue police started to look at the car. There were no signs of forced entry, which made sense because Julia said that she had left the car unlocked when she and Miley went to get gas.
Did she give any reason for that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure she did. Maybe she didn't. I don't know. But alarmingly, police found that the car had plenty of gas. In fact, when they started it up, it had no mechanical issues and worked immediately. And I saw an interview with one of the detectives, and he said that they actually drove it around and tested it all out, and there was nothing wrong with the car. Initially, Julia was cooperative with police and gave them permission to search her car and apartment. The search turned up seemingly nothing of interest, and crucially, cadaver dogs also did not hit on anything in the car. So police weren't sure exactly what had happened to Little Sky, but they knew Julia's story didn't add up. And by day two of the investigation, police said that they suspected foul play. Now, they weren't saying at this point that they believed Julia was responsible, but they believed by day two that somebody knew what happened to Sky. You know, this wasn't, he didn't walk away, you know?
Right.
It was also around this time that investigators discovered that this wasn't the first time that Sky had been left alone in a car.
Mm.
In December 2009, when Sky was about 3 months old, Julia and Solomon took him to Target. According to them, he was asleep in his car seat when they arrived and they didn't want to wake him. So instead, they left him in the car on a 27-degree day while they went shopping for 55 minutes.
Okay.
Luckily, a passerby noticed Sky in the car alone and alerted the store. The metal wallets were paged to their car where police were waiting for them. The couple was charged with child endangerment and had to take parenting classes and complete community service. The case was dismissed in early 2011 after they both fulfilled these requirements.
So there's multiple openings into their case via CPS.
Yep. And, you know, what I said before is CPS made those 6 visits starting in late 2009. So my guess is that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's kind of recap the first week of the investigation here. Julia gave police her story about Sky being sick and running out of gas on the way to the hospital. A physical search was performed on Sunday that spanned 20 blocks and included canines and a door-to-door search. Julia agreed to have her vehicle and apartment searched. Solomon was interviewed and maintained that he had not seen Sky in over a year. He agreed to have his home searched. On Monday night, Solomon agreed to take a polygraph. According to police, however, he was a wreck, so it doesn't sound like they even completed it. They told him to go home, get some rest, and they'd schedule it for another time. He took it, I believe, on the Wednesday, so like 2 days later, but police have never publicly stated the outcome. But Julia was a different story. After her initial statement and cooperation in the search, she retained an attorney who, of course, advised her not to speak to the police. She refused to take a polygraph and refused to go in for a follow-up interview. And this is all, again, November 2011. It's now April 2024 as we record this, and police have never spoken again to Julia about her son's disappearance.
I mean, you probably don't know this, but like, have they tried?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they absolutely have tried. And the answer is always, on advice of my attorney, fuck off. And they've made public pleas to her over the years. So basically, anytime this story has been in the news since 2011, police give a quote to a reporter, you know, and say, like, Julia, please come and talk to us. We want to find your son. We need your help. Every single time. So as you can imagine, when all this is initially happening, you know, in 2011 and Julia's not talking and the police are saying like her story doesn't make sense, but she won't talk to us anymore. That's when investigators and the public really started to become suspicious of her.
Yeah. And I mean, for very valid reasons.
Exactly. And police have said directly in interviews over the years that she is the one who holds the key to this investigation. At an early press conference about the case, Mike Johnson, who eventually became deputy chief with the Bellevue Police, said, quote, "We have been challenged to try and find evidence and facts to support Julia's story. You're on the way to the hospital. Why would you leave your kid in the car? It certainly is suspicious," end quote. By December 12th, Solomon was telling reporters that he too believed that Julia knew more about Sky's disappearance than she admitted to. He told King 5's Joyce Taylor that he believed his son was alive and that Julia was hiding him. Like, not personally, not that she was hiding him, but that she had someone hiding him for her.
So I am inclined to believe that based on... So the story about the hospital is... or going to the hospital or needing to go to the hospital is mm-hmm. made up.
Yeah.
Like, clearly that's not real. Same thing with having to stop for gas, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So why that neighborhood?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there have been theories that it was a good pickup / drop off point.
Right. So that's my take on that. Also, that's what I'm getting from this, is that it was a coordinated spot, but I'm left with the question of why.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's get into all of the theories now.
Okay.
All right. So we have to start with the first theory, which is what Julia said, that she left Sky, she returned, he was gone, which indicates that a stranger abducted him. Now, as we've said already, the police quickly believe that this was not the case.
Well, yeah, sure. That's the narrative that she wants to push.
Right. That was her plan. Police, right. Like, on day two, was like, I don't think so.
Right.
Now, the second theory is basically Solomon's theory, that Julia had someone hiding Skye. And even today, I've seen comments on various forums that speculate that Julia had family members taken back to Ukraine.
But why?
Basically to punish Solomon is the general answer to that.
But only one of his kids?
Yeah. Well, so apparently, we'll talk about this a little bit more, but Julia was extremely attached to Miley and Skye looked a lot like Solomon. So we'll talk about it. But, you know, getting back real quick to this idea that somebody in Julia's family took Skye to Ukraine. Like, you know, one of the things that happened is in March of 2011, her father came to visit and he had apparently she had not seen him in years and years and years. And he just happened to visit the spring before Skye disappeared or whatever. But while I do think, you know, kind of like what you were saying, that the idea that she gave Skye to someone is plausible, I do not for a second believe that he's in Ukraine. You and I have been through the process of getting passports for children without both of the birth parents, and it is quite an elaborate process for this very reason.
Yes.
So that you can't be going through a custody battle and just spirit a child away to another country.
Right.
In 2017, we had to get passports for our older boys, and we had to get a notarized letter from the other parent giving permission, and they had to submit copies of their IDs along with that notarized letter. We also had to take the kids into the passport office in person. So the parents had to be in person to give their permission. The kids had to be in person at the passport office. It was a very long process. And in a post 9/11 world, I just don't see anyone being able to get Skye out of the country in this manner, at least not just this random family, right? Like if you have a very, you know, like an international criminal organization, like sure, but that's not what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think that that's an easy solution to this, a quote unquote easy solution.
Mm-hmm.
As to where Skye might be, but I don't think it's a very realistic solution.
No, I don't think it is either. And police have also stated that they, of course, did investigate this avenue.
Sure.
But they also do not believe that that's what happened. Now, the third, and again, related theory, is that Julia sold Skye or gave him up for an illegal adoption. In the years since his son's disappearance, this is the theory that Solomon seems to hold. He has said in every interview that he believes his son is alive out there somewhere, and he has vowed to never stop looking for him. The fourth and worst theory is that Julia killed Skye and staged the abduction to cover her tracks. Like I just said, Skye is the spitting image of his father. And so this theory goes that having to look at him every day basically drove her to a breaking point.
I mean, yeah. I don't mean to come across as insensitive here. It's not necessarily driving her to a breaking point, given her mental health history, that perhaps she was already on that path, exacerbated by Solomon's actions and just the totality of everything and postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I mean, I could see how that could play out.
Yeah.
As a very realistic situation.
Right. And, you know, this became a popular theory early on, especially once it was discovered that the night before Skye was reported missing, a rerun of Law and Order SVU aired with nearly this exact plot.
What?
Yeah. And like any other 30-year-old woman, Julia obviously loved Law and Order. So there's a good chance that she had seen this. And in the episode, a woman is in the middle of a difficult divorce. She calls police and says that her car was stolen outside of a convenience store with her son buckled in the back seat. Of course, it's later found out that she had killed her son and had lied about this car theft in order to cover that up. Another theory that's related to this is that Julia didn't snap and murder Skye, but instead he died accidentally
And Julia was trying to cover that up. And that's kind of related in that in court documents, Solomon did accuse her of neglecting the children, of not feeding them, et cetera, et cetera. So something could have just happened accidentally.
Absolutely.
Now, remember that 11-hour mediation session that took place the week before he was reported missing?
Yes.
Police said that there was a possibility that both of the children had been left home alone during that entire time.
Okay.
Bellevue police, to my knowledge, have never come out and definitively confirmed that that's what happened, but it's been mentioned several times, the possibility. So could Skye have died of dehydration or other accidental means? Because, you know, you got to think, all right, they're alone for 11 hours. Who knows when he ate or drank before that? He's probably asleep by the time she got home. So if he's asleep, let's say, he doesn't eat or drink for another however many hours. And when you're dehydrated like that, when you don't eat, you can become lethargic. And so maybe she didn't realize that something was wrong until it was too late. To me, this seems very possible, but one person seems to contradict this theory. Miley. Now, Miley was 4 when all this happened, and she was about 3 months from turning 5. Because of her young age, police were very careful with how they interviewed her.
As they should be.
Yeah. Now, I don't know exactly when this happened, but at some point, a specially trained FBI agent did talk to Miley. And during this interview, she stated that Skye was in the car that morning on November 6th and that he was wrapped in a blanket. Now, there are a couple ways you can take that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, you know, our minds
the obvious,
to the worst
yeah.
one
yeah.
immediately, that maybe he was wrapped in a blanket and he was in the car, but not alive at
right.
the time.
Yeah.
But there are photos of both of the children, you know, previously, right, strapped into their car seats with blankets like on them.
Sure.
So that could be what she meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that maybe she wrapped Skye up in a blanket to take him to the car,
mm-hmm.
which would make sense.
Yeah.
He's sick, gets cold. She wraps him up in a blanket, carries him to the car, puts him in the car seat, puts the blanket on him. So it could be just that.
Yeah.
However, the only person outside of Julia or her family who reported seeing Skye in the days leading up to his disappearance is a neighbor who said that they saw the little boy 2 weeks prior to November 6th. To my knowledge, in the 11 plus years since his disappearance, that is the last reported independent sighting. The last photographic evidence of Skye seems to be from the summer, several months before he was reported missing. I believe July, if I'm not mistaken.
So no CCTV footage of that day, the Montessori school?
No, I think that the only CCTV footage was from the parking garage at the apartment building, which is how we got that 7:20 a.m. time that they left.
Yeah.
And at the gas station. And then we have the time of the 911 call. But yeah, that's, to my knowledge, the only footage that's involved. The last photos of him, like I said, were from the summer. And photos also played into the investigator's suspicions surrounding Julia. Both on her Facebook page and in her apartment, police stated that there were many photos of Miley, but very few of Skye. And, you know, this could be a sign of favoritism,
mm-hmm.
but what if it reveals something deeper? Unfortunately, we've covered cases of parents who murdered their small children and reported them missing long after the fact. As I was initially researching this case, I was thinking that that could be the situation here. But Miley, who was almost 5, said that Skye was, in fact, in the car that morning. The people who interviewed her were highly trained in interviewing small children in this exact situation, and many people who are closely involved with the case believe that what she said was true.
Sure. But that doesn't take into consideration the possibility that she took the kids to that location and took Miley out of the car so that there could be a pass off, an easy pass off where there's no witnesses.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. If what Miley is saying is true, then that could still also absolutely be true, right? Uh-huh. It would just indicate that Sky likely was alive on November 6th.
Right.
Right. But as I was going through those court documents, something struck me. In a declaration that Solomon filed on February 1st, 2011, he said this about Julia and Miley. Quote, "Julia has developed an unusual bond with our daughter. Miley is now only 4 years old. In March 2010, she was three. Julia worked on a means by which she would make statements to Miley, which Miley would parrot back. The most infamous line was the statement, 'I am going to kill myself.' Julia said that so often that soon Miley would pick it up and say it, obviously without understanding the meaning. This is one reason why we started going down this path that has brought us to court. Miley will say what she is told to say as long as she thinks that there is some reward for continuing to play along." End quote. Now, once again, Solomon and Julia were in the middle of an incredibly contentious divorce. But the fact that he said this 9 months prior to Sky being reported missing and Miley backing Julia's story up, in my opinion, should not go unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that I've ever seen brought up in any of the articles that I've read. Like I said, I only saw that from going through the court documents. In an interview 3 years after Sky's disappearance, Solomon told reporters that Miley, who was then seven, had no memories of that morning. After a state custody hearing a month after Sky was reported missing, Solomon was granted custody of Miley, and Julia was granted supervised visitation. I'm unclear if Julia ever visited with her daughter, however. Solomon has said that he hasn't spoken to his ex-wife since Sky disappeared. But again, that doesn't mean that Julia never visited her, because they were supervised visits and Solomon would not have been involved. But I've also seen no indication that she was involved in Miley's life after this point. As far as I have been able to tell, Miley, who turns 18 this year, still resides with Solomon, but the family has moved out of state. Julia seems to have remained in Washington, but despite not talking to police about her son's disappearance, she hasn't stayed out of the news. In July 2015, Julia was remarried and gave birth to another baby boy whom she named Elijah, which was Sky's middle name. Her new husband was a man named Adam Morgan, a convicted felon who was incarcerated at the time of his son's birth. CPS immediately became involved and tried to take the child out of Julia's custody due to her mental health concerns. Her husband had also previously had a child removed from his custody when he lived in Florida. According to court documents, the couple married in December 2014, but that same month, Julia accused her new husband of domestic violence after an incident on Christmas Eve when he broke down the door of their apartment and assaulted her. He pled guilty to malicious mischief, third-degree domestic violence, and was ordered not to have contact with Julia. Now, the reason Adam was in jail at the time of his son's birth was because he violated this protective order. However, Julia allegedly visited him several times in jail using fake names. She also petitioned the court to have the no-contact order lifted, saying that not living with her husband caused her a financial hardship. And she also claimed to be homeless at one point, changed her address to a P.O. box, said she didn't have any family in the area, even though her mother did still live there. And she eventually went and stayed with her mother.
Right.
Adam was released in October 2014 and ordered to attend rehab. He did not comply, and a bench warrant was issued for his arrest. Julia was ordered to attend a custody hearing for Elijah in November. I don't know what eventually happened with Adam. They eventually ended up getting divorced. Don't know where he is now, but the custody issues with Elijah dragged on for years.
and Julia was back in court in February 2019. When confronted by reporters outside, she again refused to speak about Sky. During the hearing, she admitted that she was not permitted to see Elijah without a monitor, so it does seem as though she was only allowed to have supervised visitation with her son. And I'm not sure where that relationship stands today. The main question that remained after the initial dust settled was, why wasn't Julia arrested for child endangerment? At the very least, she left a 2-year-old alone in a car for an hour in 27-degree weather. Bellevue police addressed this question directly, saying that this was a strategic decision.
On their management's part?
Well, okay, so Bellevue police spokesperson Seth Tyler told reporters in 2014 that in order to charge Julia with child endangerment, they would have to prove that Sky was in fact in the car in the first place. So if they were able to get a conviction based on that, and later evidence showed that Sky was never in the car and that he had in fact died prior to the morning of November 6th, then that would basically decimate any further murder case.
Right.
Right. Because any defense lawyer would be like, listen, you guys are just making shit up. Right.
Right.
Now, I spent way too much time trying to find the actual statute that Julia would have been charged under because I was curious. I'm like, OK, well, that makes sense initially. But after years go by and you're not getting anywhere, like maybe then you arrest her for this and just, I don't know, roll the dice. So anyway, I like went through a whole Google thing and the closest charge that I could find was abandonment of a dependent person in the first degree. Because despite what all of these newspaper articles said with Julian Solomon being charged with child endangerment, that's not actually a charge in Washington state. Like, that's not what it's called. It's like they're different statute, whatever. The point is that the closest thing I could see would be abandonment of a dependent person in the first degree. Now, this is a Class C felony. And from what I could find online, which, again, I am not an attorney, the statute of limitations appears to be 5 years on that. So that was a gamble that appears to have not paid off.
Mm.
Given all of that, and the fact that cadaver dogs never hit on the car or, you know, and I don't know if cadaver dogs were brought into the apartment at all. I'm not entirely sure on that. They did do a search of the landfill at one point nearby. Nothing was found.
Police did do a search of the apartment, though, right?
Yeah. Just yeah, but not, I just don't know if dogs. Cadaver, yeah, I don't know.
Not that we know of.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know if had cadaver dogs been there, if they would have hit on something, you know, whatever. There was a search done in the landfill. I mean, there could be a possibility that Sky is still out there somewhere, that Julia did give or sell him to somebody. Now, the selling thing, again, financially, there's no proof of that.
I'm just left with the same thing of you know, why?
Revenge, mental illness, punishment. I mean, you know, that
I guess but only one of his kids though?
Yeah, because like, I think she believed that losing Sky would hurt him more. He was the son.
Yeah,
he looked like Solomon.
Yeah,
I think that she thought that that would hurt him more.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's all conjecture though.
Of course it is. The case is unsolved. Our entire show is conjecture.
Sure.
And this is a case in which there is seemingly, you know, as far as we know, little to no physical evidence. So in situations like this, it's important that people talk. But Julia, the one who everyone believes holds all of the answers, is still refusing nearly 13 years later. Miley, like I said, gave a story shortly thereafter. When she was 7, Solomon says she didn't remember anything. I don't know if that's still the case, if she might have memories from that day, if she could possibly unlock memories from that day or the days leading up to this.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah.
But maybe someday something will come to her that could lead to a resolution one way or the other in this case.
Julia has mainly stayed out of the public eye in the intervening years since that 2019 custody case I was talking about. And she's mostly kept out of trouble outside of a 2021 shoplifting arrest for stealing clothes from Costco. On the 10th anniversary of his son's disappearance, Solomon told reporters that he hasn't given up on finding his son, saying that there is no evidence that Sky isn't out there somewhere. A new age-progressed photo was released in 2020 showing a 10-year-old Sky. Solomon hopes that somewhere someone will see it and think, quote, "You know, there's something a little different about me. I really don't act like my brothers. I don't really look like my brothers and sisters or my parents. I think that's what I'm really hoping for," end quote. Sky Metalwala has been missing from Bellevue, Washington since November 6, 2011. He is a biracial Middle Eastern and Caucasian male with brown hair and brown eyes. Sky was 2'10" and approximately 28 pounds when he went missing. He was 2 years old when he disappeared. He would be 14 today. If anyone has any information regarding this case, they are urged to contact the Bellevue Police Department by sending an email to pdtipline@bellevuewa.gov or calling 425-452-2564. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!